Recording. I think it's recording. Yes. So I even in that initial meeting, I had asked her what books I could read. Because of course that was how I approached things at that time, was reading books. And she said, no books. No books. And I insisted, and so she said, okay, finally, you can read this book. And it was her teacher's first book, which had just come out. It's called The Eye Never Sleeps. And it had just been published, and she had copies of it. And so she said I could buy one from her. And this was at the time when we still had francs. We didn't have euros yet. And I think it was 50 francs or something. And I only had a 200 franc note. And she didn't have any change. So she said, well, that's okay. This was right before I was leaving when we had this exchange. And she said, well, that's okay. You can pay me the next time we see each other. And I said, yes, okay. But there was absolutely no reason why I should ever see this woman again in my life. She showed me how to meditate. We talked. I asked her various questions about, you know, things and groups, and she didn't have a group. You know, there was absolutely no reason that I should ever see her again. And yet, when she said, you can pay me the next time you see me, I said, yes, of course, because I guess it was just obvious that I was going to see her again, but it wasn't coming from my head. And I did see her again a month later. I went to a retreat that she organized. It was the first time I ever was in a Zen retreat, ever sitting with other people and anything. So when I was thinking about this, and I thought about my own path then since then, and about this mystery, something mysterious, and about the heart. Because that's what I wrote to her in the message, was I was answering some mysterious call in my heart. And I realized that mystery and that call and that heart, love, whatever you want to call it, has just deepened and become more clear as I've practiced all these years. And it was thanks to her. She was the vehicle through which, or in which, that could be developed, could be seen, could be recognized. In the beginning, I think it translated as kind of my love for her. I loved my teacher. And I think but it has shifted. Of course, I still love my teacher, but it's shifted. I realized, without me even realizing it, it's like that image that I give of walking through a field at dawn and getting wet. You don't even realize that you're getting wet until you're no longer in the field. And it's something like that, that through that love for her and that opening of my heart to myself, by listening to that call and answering that call in my heart, and thinking initially that it was just about a love for her, I was able to deepen that and expand it and recognize it in myself and recognize it in everyone and in everything. And it so happens that yesterday I went on a walk with a friend. It was very hot in Paris. We went for a walk in a park here in my neighborhood. And I'm still not able to walk long distances. You know, I'm still working it up. But I really wanted to push myself. And so we went on this long walk. And during the walk, we were talking about our various experiences. And I was telling her about my experience being sick and what I'd experienced and this whole thing of humility and humanity and vulnerability and love, right? And she heard everything I was saying. And she said, oh yeah, I think, whatever. But it wasn't it. The words were not conveying my experience. And I was very sad about this. And at first I thought it was because I was tired, because it was hot, because I was worried that I would wear myself out or something. And when I came home, I wrote in my journal and I said, how can I find the words? How can I translate this experience to words? Because it was so unsatisfactory. And I let go of it. You know, I said, okay, I'm not going to become obsessed with this dissatisfaction. Because I have that could have been a possible path, being dissatisfied. And this morning, I opened up this book that I've been reading, I've been talking about occasionally from a French philosopher, Michel Serres. And he was talking about, actually, I read these passages last night, but it was in a passage about, he was trying to figure out why Christians believe in Christ returning from the dead, which is something that everyone knows is impossible. No one has ever seen anyone come back from the dead. And yet, there are millions and millions and millions of people throughout the centuries who believe deeply in this resurrection of Christ, right? And he's this philosopher, and he's studying the texts, and he's really going deeply into it. And his interpretation, which when I read it, I said, that's exactly it. It's a very Zen interpretation. Was that he goes into the fact that when the tomb is empty, people come and they find the tomb empty, right? It's open and there's the body is no longer there. And then there are stories of people who met him and didn't recognize him. And there's even the case of Thomas, who we call Doubting Thomas, right? Who will only believe it's him if he can feel where he was crucified. So feel his wounds. He wants to touch his wounds, right? And so this philosopher, Michel Serres, interprets this as he's not recognized because people are looking for someone else. They don't see he's resurrected in everyone and everything, in the 10,000 things. So they don't recognize that he's the beggar beside the road. They don't recognize that he's the woman selling flowers. They don't recognize that he's the homeless person. And the real one that they don't recognize is they don't recognize that it's themselves. That's the big obstacle, is seeing that it's me, right? We're looking for something else, someone else. So all of these people in the biblical story, they don't recognize him because they're looking for something else. And when they do recognize him in everything. So as Michel Serres says, in French he says, aimer consiste à reconnaître le divin chez l'autre. So love means recognizing that the other, we would say in our Zen jargon, the other is me. The other is divine. I am divine and the other is divine. Not God, but Mu, maybe we would say in our jargon. It, we would say, you know, just this, the other is it. The other is perfect. I am perfect. The 10,000 things are it. We see the divine in everything, including ourselves, right? And that is what my practice with my teacher allowed me to see. First, I only saw it in her. And I reduced it to her. And then it could expand. That was a good focus for it. And as she responded to me when I wrote this message to her yesterday, or the day before, she responded to me and saying, what happiness it is for me that I could be the vehicle for you to realize that. She knows that it's not about her. She knows she's just a vehicle. And so she said, what happiness that I could be that vehicle, and what joy that you now can be that vehicle through which it passes as well. And so you can be that vehicle for others. The same applies to all, for all of us, actually. We all are that vehicle. And I realized when I was so dissatisfied with my words that I used with my friend, that it's not about using words, you know, that you have to be it. Right? You can explain it, but the best way to convey whatever it is, love, it, to manifest oneness and diversity is to truly be it. And in order to truly be it, to truly manifest it, we have to stop looking for it somewhere else, because otherwise we won't recognize it. It's like the people who didn't recognize Christ. They weren't looking for Christ in the person that beside the road. They weren't looking for Christ in wearing a different kind of clothing or speaking another language, or being a woman instead of a man, or being a rock or a tree or a cat. They weren't looking for it there. And the same goes for us. We're not looking for it here. We think it's somewhere else, someone else, something else. And in that light, I endlessly see this name that my teacher gave me of Tu es cela, you are it. It's the same thing as saying, you are the way. You are divine. You are love. You are what you're looking for. There's nothing else. You don't have to look for anything else. If you find you, you will find the 10,000 things. just to stay with our Zen jargon. And there is the famous, there's another famous scene when Christ comes back to, he comes to Jerusalem on Palm Sunday. And what we now call Palm Sunday, but at the time it wasn't called Palm Sunday. And he says to the Roman soldiers, whatever, who are, could arrest him, you know, he said, "You can stop me. You can shut me up. You can arrest me. But the rocks and trees will keep talking. Will keep saying it. If we can truly see that, everything is said. Everything is done. I don't know if my friend heard what I said yet. I know she heard my words, but I don't know what she got out of it. But it doesn't matter so much, you know. I guess what matters most is that I realize that the best way is to be it instead of trying to say it. Sometimes being it means saying it. And we have to say something. When I first started teaching, I didn't know what to say, and so I didn't want to say anything. And someone from my Sangha, someone far more experienced than me, Barbara, some of you know her, gave me a book. The title was, "You Have to Say Something." And it's true. You do, you have to say something. But it's usually not what you think you have to say. It's like the people who don't see Christ. It's not what you're looking for. Which is part of the beauty of the koan practice, is because it puts us in that place of discovering what we weren't looking for. Experiencing directly what we didn't see because we were looking somewhere else for something else. Yeah. That's already a huge thing, though, to see this notion of Christ being resurrected, because he's in all of us. That's, wow. It's not usually the interpretation that we get from the church. At least, I mean, I was raised Christian as a child, but I've not pursued any Christian practice ever since then. But that changes radically my experience of what it is. You know, we are all Christ. That was his message. And when we don't see that, then we create a lot of trouble for ourselves and for others. We have this koan that is from Layman Pang, who was a lay person, you know, he's like Tomas with two kids, and Tomas has one kid, but on his lap, but a lay person, two kids, wife, has to make a living, and the whole family practices. They make baskets, they weave baskets and sell them in marketplaces to survive, and they go around from and see different masters throughout China. And at one point, he is at a monastery, and some monks from the monastery are accompanying him to the gate to leave, which is a sign that he was probably considered to be a very honored guest. He was friends with some of the great Zen masters of the time, although he was a layperson himself. And so if an honored guest was leaving, then there would be a group of monks who would accompany him to the gate. And he got to the gate and it was snowing when they looked outside. And he said, "Beautiful snowflakes. They don't fall in a different place." The snowflakes each fall exactly in the perfect place. None of them falls in the same place. And we know that no two snowflakes are alike. When we look under a microscope, we see that they're crystals that are, each one is different. No two are the same. And yet when we look, we just see snow. We say snow. And yet snow is an aggregate of many, 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 many individual flakes, crystals. And they each fall exactly in the perfect place. This is the same for us. We each fall exactly in our place. We're each different, and yet we each fall in the same place. In our same place, our place. Not, we don't fall in the same place, we each fall in our place. Which is a way of saying we don't need to be someone else. We don't need to be somewhere else. We're exactly in the spot that is ours. And our life as it is the life of the Buddha, is the life of Christ, is the life of the perfect snowflake that we are. This seems to make sense when we say the words like this, but we don't always feel that way. We want to be different. We want to be somewhere else. We don't want to be our age. We don't want to live in the place we live. We don't want the circumstances of our life. But what if we just with open arms received it all? We just said, "Beautiful snowflake. Beautiful snowflake." So, anyone want to say something? Question? Comment? If you do, you will have to unmute yourself.
Roshi.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it's actually very obvious. This is my own life. From that place of realizing that even if there is something that I want to change or I need to change, it's very different because it comes from a very different perspective. It's not about changing something out of a pure desire to change something. But maybe that's not completely accurate. I'm not sure. But anyway, the experience is, I'm trying to put in words, it's the it feels like the perspective, the whole perspective is very different. And even maybe the desire to change something, it feels completely different. It's something else. It's a different experience. It's not just because I hate something about my life or I'm bored. It's different. It's a different experience.
And maybe
it's like looking at everything from like a different angle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and maybe it's enough to recognize it, that you don't maybe need to give it any words. You know what you're talking, you recognize it in your heart, the difference. So maybe it's not so important to be able to explain or whatever. Because you know the difference, and it will become more clear as you go and trust it.
Yes, and I guess words come easier, more accurate when the experience is more clear, maybe in the heart. It's not that it's difficult to put in words. It's not maybe the experience. It's not so clear. Because even if the experience is not very clear, I know when the word, sometimes the word or the words don't feel enough accurate enough. And I feel it. Thank you.
That's like the experience I described of going on the walk with my friend and not finding the words.
Roshi?
Mm-hmm.
I find this this is going to sound so simplistic, but it's really true, much easier to accept when life is pleasant. When adversities, when I'm in a conflict situation, the example that I can always use because I still don't understand it is, why did somebody steal my raccoon zoo? Does it make any difference? And then I went over all the other things that people have stolen from me. And you're supposed to say, oh, but my experience is a mirror. And if I'm being stolen from, I want to steal, but I don't want to steal. That one, I mean, at least that one I've gotten used to. But there are other things. I found myself in a situation with somebody who really didn't like me this week, whom I didn't know didn't like me. And that's happened before, too, where I, yes, I'm a beautiful snowflake, but I feel a little bit dirty or a beautiful snowflake. I have a hard time. What is the purpose of this, or does it make any difference? Sometimes I think I'm just, you know, just I'm with people that are unhappy. But if there's any kind of repetitive pattern like being stolen from, after a while I think, well, what is this? Does this mean something, or should I just get on with it?
Yeah, you know, we do like to see the, find some explanation or some pattern. We do like that. In the case of someone not liking you, it has to do with the other person. Of course, you can look into, well, is there something that I am not seeing? Am I not paying attention to them? It depends what it is, the situation. But if someone likes you or doesn't like you, you have no control over it. And there's no reason to have any control over it because it doesn't really concern you. Because if you see that you are the beautiful snowflake, then you, that's, you are enough as you are. And the other liking or disliking takes nothing away from that. It's interesting that you should mention your Rakusu, because that then brings us to your Dharma name. For those of you who don't know, when we had the center in Paris, the center was broken into twice in the space of a few weeks. And each time some things were stolen, and things like all of the kitchen equipment and I don't even remember what the stuff was that was stolen. But one of the things that was stolen, two Rakusus were stolen. One was Debbie's, which she had just finished making, and she had given it to me to write on. And she had left it at the center. I had not, she left it there one day when I was not there. And I was supposed to pick it up and then write on it because her Jukai was coming up very soon. And so there was nothing written on it. It was a brand new Rakusu, blank. And the other Rakusu was a very old Rakusu. Someone who, you know, was 20 years old, the Rakusu, and kind of old and tattered. And it did have writing on the back of it. And those two Rakusus were taken. None of the others were taken. You know, all of my like amazing, beautiful, fancy Rakusus, they didn't touch them. They just took two black ones, one old and one brand new. So this, of course, you can imagine was traumatic for all of us, but especially for Debbie, who just made this. And gone, all of you who have made a Rakusu, you know what you go through making a Rakusu, right? And then anticipating your Jukai and being ready for it and everything, and then it's gone. And not being able to understand why. We still, for weeks, months, we tried to figure out why they took those Rakusus. Because they were worthless. I mean, what did they weren't going to sell them on eBay or something. I mean, what were they going to do with those Rakusus, you know? And they even, I don't remember with Debbie, no, Debbie's didn't have a case, did it, yours, Debbie? No. But the other one, Brigitte's, did. It was in a case, you know, it was in an envelope. And they took it out of the envelope and left the envelope. So we have no idea why they took it. I gave up on trying to figure it out. But Debbie made another requisite in record time. I forget how quickly, but very quickly. And she had help from João Rodriguez, who lives next door, and another woman, Eugenia. And so she spent a lot of time with them sewing her records. And so I sat with, what name am I going to give Debbie? And what first came to mind when the robbery happened was, and when I was thinking about Debbie, was that there a story we have of a poet, a Zen poet, who was a hermit and had almost nothing. You know, he had like a bowl, a blanket, you know, maybe a pair of shoes or something. I don't know. He had nothing, right? And he was out and he came back one night and someone had taken everything that he had from his little hut. And he looked out the window and he said, I forget, it's very poetic the way he says it, but basically says, you know, he looks at the bright moon and he said, at least they didn't take the moon, the bright moon. Well, and this bright moon, in Zen jargon, the moon, the hazy moon, bright moon, the moon is our true self. It's a recognition of our true self, right? And that cannot be stolen. The name I gave Debbie was Bright Moon. It was the most perfect name for her, for that moment, for that situation. No, everything was taken from her. Everything was taken, not the bright moon. And then there's an addendum to this story. She went back and talked to the people who, João was at the Jukai. João Rodriguez came to her Jukai. And after the ceremony, he said to Debbie, do you know what the name is of Eugenia? Eugenia is the woman who helped her with her rakusu. What her Dharma name is? And Debbie said, no, and Bright Moon. Which is, I had no idea Eugenia's name was Bright Moon. I didn't even know Eugenia had a rakusu. I mean, I don't even really know Eugenia, but... interesting, huh? That was really the name for Debbie. That was really it. And so that is a big long circuit to come back to the beautiful snowflake, you know, to come back to whether people like you or not. Bright moon. Well, if no one else wants to add something, I think that's a really good place to stop. I want to remind you of, I think next Thursday will be our last talk. I'm not sure, I think that's when we decided to end. We then, the first week in August, have our online retreat, which I also encourage you all to join. Even if you think during the week you may only come for one or two talks, or you may only sit from time to time, please register anyway so that you can have the link and come when you're free. even if it's only you come on Thursday night or something. If you can, I encourage you to try to really do it the week. I know in Portugal, a few people are getting together, sitting together in a place together. In France, we can't do that, unfortunately, but let's really try to make this a full retreat, like, as if we were together, because we are together. So there will be an email going out soon with information about how to sign up, and anything else we need to know, the schedule, whatever. And I also will be sending, probably after that, sometime in August maybe, or before, an email about a year from now, the retreat when Joel will receive transmission, so that you can start planning for that and save your money, save the date, because really, really, I really want everyone to come. Even if you can only come for a few days at the end, it's very special. It's a very special time for the Sangha, for all of us. I don't know if there's any other announcements I need to make. Can anyone think of anything that I'm forgetting? I think the daily practices continue all next week too. And we haven't decided yet in the fall if we will, what we will continue online and not. We're hoping that in Paris we will be able to sit together, but we'll see. Everything is uncertain, of course. We've made the schedule for all the way through next year at this time. Then that will be posted soon. And so we have the dates for me to come to Portugal in the fall and in the spring. So that's where we are right now. So shall we end with the vows? João?
I should post the text, right?